Hi, I'm Richard Fish. This is Making It in Movie Making. In this episode of the podcast, I talk to Keith Allott. Now, he's a filmmaker whose film Lifelike we're going to discuss a lot in the episode. But full disclosure, I actually recorded this episode with Keith about a year ago, and I put the podcast on hold while I made my feature film, What You Can't Promise, that you can find on Instagram. And so some of the information in the podcast, I might be letting Keith down a bit with it being out of date. So I feel like I need to open by saying the movie Lifelike, which we do discuss quite a bit, has had lots of success in film festivals. I've been following Keith's social media presence and seeing what he's been up to. And what I can announce is that the film will be at the upcoming New York City Indie Film Festival. That's between the 13th and 19th of June. So if you hear about Lifelike and you happen to be able to get to New York, then go and support Keith. Okay, I hope you enjoy the episode, and I will get back to recording many more of these as soon as possible because I have met a lot of interesting people in the past year who I think would be fantastic guests.
Hello, and welcome to Making It in Movie Making. I'm Richard Fish, and today I'm talking to Keith Allott, who is an independent filmmaker. In fact, I'll let you tell me. Can you tell me a bit about what it is you do, Keith?
Yeah, absolutely. My name's Keith Allott. I am a filmmaker, which is quite a difficult thing to say sometimes. I think I was talking to two producers yesterday and just saying what you are like that sometimes is a bit funny, you know, when you do that. So it's something you've always wanted to do and then you say it. Filmmaker, run my own production company, and I work on my own projects. So I make narrative fiction films, documentary films, experimental films. I work with clients across the UK. I do quite a lot of work that's usually based around social conscious issues. So it might be to do with listening to youth voice. It might be to do with domestic violence or some form of drugs or knife crime, things that are affecting people out there. We're planning a film at the moment about youth work. So quite a lot of things that have a social angle to them. I work a lot as well as a producer for emerging filmmakers. So working with young filmmakers or adult filmmakers who are just starting out and making things and produce their work and hopefully give them good advice. And I also teach. I teach at various different places, including De Montfort University International College, University of Leicester. I teach on the BFI academies and as part of bespoke courses for places like the Phoenix Cinema in Leicester, the independent cinema here in Leicester. So basically, you name it film-wise, and I probably do it. It's a passion all my life, and I count myself very lucky to be able to do it for a living.
I feel like I should have been taking notes because at various points it's like, okay, I need to ask about this. Okay, so you were saying about calling yourself a filmmaker. So how long had you been making films before you were like, okay, this is what I am, I'm a filmmaker? Like, when did you give yourself permission to have that label?
A long time, quite a long time. I quite often mentioned that my path of getting into this was, there are really sort of fragile moments in life, I think, where you become something, and if that didn't happen, then that would never have come to fruition. And I was working at the Leicester Mercury, which is a newspaper in Leicester, and I was working in the recruitment department there, and I got a phone call. Somebody wanted to place an advert for a course, which it's not really my job, but I can find where you need to. What's the course about? It's a filmmaking course. I'm like, oh, okay, fine. Well, I don't know who that is, but I'll find them for you. But can you put my name down for the course? And I went and did the course. It was really enjoyable. We made a really good film, which I look back on now, and it's not so great, but it was a really cool experience. This was sort of the first time I'd gone back to film since university, and I kept going down to the place where the course was and got involved with them down there and ended up working there. And from there, you know, worked on lots of projects, worked for the Phoenix very briefly, and then went into my own business. You know, without that phone call, I wouldn't sort of been down this line. But, you know, I've owned my own production company now for 10 years, and I'd probably say I've only been comfortable really calling myself that since then, I think. And I've been making films probably 20 years now, so probably been doing it for about 10 years or so before I felt confident and able to say it. And it is a funny thing to say, you know, when you are an artist of any form, I think, and actually you can say it, like, that's what I am. It's funny. When I started to work at the community studios in Leicester, for about 6 months, I think it was, my mum thought it was my hobby and not my job. So it's like to tell her, like, no, actually, I get paid to do that. It's like, yeah, okay. So I think it's kind of a rare thing to do. I count myself very lucky to be in a position where to do it. So yeah, I think it takes a long time before I was happy to say it or comfortable to say it, I think. Comfortable is probably the best word.
Did you say you'd been making films at uni and then there was a gap before you started again?
Yeah, I mean, at the time I was at university, you know, you're talking like 97, I think it was, to 2000, 2001, around there. A lot of filmmaking, when we were learning at university, it was tape-to-tape editing. So quite, you know, what we would say now is quite basic equipment, I suppose, but extremely expensive. So access to actually filming was really tough. You know, we were still working on things like Beta and SVHS cameras and things like that. Just moving into probably around 2003, around there when we did the course, moving into things like nonlinear editing and digital editing and that sort of thing. So filmmaking was really tough to do, really tough to get into, really. You couldn't do it as easily as you can do now. It wasn't as accessible. So at university was really my first contact with cameras and edit equipment. And we went out and worked on that. I used to hate editing because it's like hours and hours and hours and hours. Now, you know, so
ironically, while talking about editing, we had a fluff. So now there's going to be a little bit of a jump that you'll have all just heard. Let's continue.
So did you get I think it was talking about editing, is that right? And yeah, you take hours to do it at university. Yeah, so I used to, it was probably the part of the filming process that I like the least, because I'm quite an immediate person, quite like things to be, I get on them quickly and get and working on them, and editing took hours and hours. And yeah, it was something that, that kit, that equipment, and the cost of it was just, it was inaccessible. And so, you know, at the age of like 22, 23, and I got the phone call for the course, that was brilliant, because, you know, I'd been back home from university for about a year or two and hadn't really found anything. I couldn't afford to buy anything. And then this course came along. And so I did that and got involved with the community studios and worked with them. And I got access to equipment and other filmmakers and people from the course and started to make things from there and move forward. So that gap from university to that course was basically all to do with, I just could not afford equipment. There was no accessibility to it there. So taking that phone call by accident was the thing, really. That was the link. That's what's got me where I am now. If I hadn't took that phone call, probably wouldn't have been making films.
So who was running that course and how did it work?
So the community studios were running the course. It was called Line Out. It was based at the Foss Arts Centre in Leicester. And the course was called Max Q. It was a 12-week course, and you basically went through the start of the production process all the way through to the end, and concluded with a screening of the films that you created. I think it was about 15 people. We split into two groups, and you all assigned, you yourself sort of assigned roles. So when you're in group, you just discuss what you wanted to do. I got to direct, which was good. That's what I wanted to do. And we directed a film called Vacant Possession, which was about... it's a misdirection film where somebody was being given directions to a house over the phone that they were going to view, and the estate agent was going to meet them there. They get there and they get sort of chased by this group of men who are sort of going to assault them, and they get to the house, they get beckoned into safety, but it turns out that it's actually a ghost there, and there's a misdirection about who's arriving at the house and who's not. It did all right. We won an award for it, actually, which is quite a surprise, the Leicester International Film Festival. And it was just a really cool experience. Really enjoyed it. And like I say, good introduction to the community as well, which I think any good course at like an independent cinema or stuff will do. You meet other people who are like-minded, and hopefully you can continue to make things.
So once the course was over, how did you continue to make things?
There were people around who I worked with, like-minded people who I'd enjoyed spending time with. We worked on a couple of projects there, and a job came up at the community studios, which I applied for. I didn't get the one I applied for, but it was a position created, and I got that. And then eventually I sort of moved into sort of running or being manager at that place.
Was that the one that your mum thought was a hobby?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my mum thought it was a hobby for about 6 months. Yeah, and then it was a case of meeting lots and lots more filmmakers at that time, and more people. Everybody coming through the door, I could meet and talk to, and stuff. There were filmmakers who were resident there as well, and it was just really cool to meet people who were doing that. Got a really good introduction to the art scene in Leicester as well, and understanding different art forms and working with people, and you know, understanding their processes, understanding funding and applying for funding and that sort of thing. So yeah, that was the continuation of it, really, from the course, was working with those people around and getting a job there and meeting more and more people.
So have you always been able to make money in one way or another through either teaching filmmaking or making films since then?
When I left the job I was in to work at the community studios, I took quite a big cut in what I'd been earning. But it sort of felt like, well, you know, here's an opportunity. Either you go for it, you don't. You don't want to sit there. You know, I could be sat here now going, oh, if only I, you know, took that risk and done it, then I might have been making films. And I didn't want that to be a thing. So it was hard for a while because I was earning less than I'd earned before. But as it progressed and, you know, you get better at what you do, it was the next major change really was sort of when I'd been working at the Phoenix for a little bit. There was a sort of kind of a kind of merge between the community studios and the Phoenix Cinema, and the new Phoenix building was built and we transferred over to there. And I left there after about 9 months, and the opportunity was there then to work for myself. And it was, can I do that? Is, you know, you got to get used to not being paid monthly and, you know, budgeting for that. At that point, that's probably the bigger risk and the biggest thing I've done when it came to getting paid for film work. But fortunately, because of the background I got of like 6 years of working in the community studios and working with different artists and different art forms and understanding the funding elements of things, I could put all that into exercise and work and hopefully build a client base and a reputation, which hopefully has happened. I mean, I'm still here 11 years later and working on in that way and earning money from it, from both production and from teaching. I think it's important to establish what you are. I always say I'm a filmmaker who teaches and I'm not a teacher who filmmakes. So I have to try and get that mix right and, you know, try and limit it to about 2 days a week of teaching and the rest is production, which being a freelancer doesn't mean three, it means four. So, you know, you will be working at weekends and things. But it's, yeah, it's tough and it is difficult. And I hopefully help and hopefully try to advise people who are starting out as freelancers on things that they can do to increase the opportunity to earn money. But I recognise how hard it is. It's a very difficult thing to do.
So, I mean, just looking at some of the films I could find that you've done, it seems like you've got a mix of kind of narrative shorts and then, as you were saying, sort of documentaries or kind of socially conscious films. So is that where the money comes from? Do you like have briefs where you'll like make videos and films for a certain group or organisation?
Yeah, you know, anything I make that's mine. So recently we made a film called Lifelike with Michael Miyunda, who you spoke to recently, and Kim Allen, and written by a guy called Kevin Richmond Walls, and involving really, really talented group. You know, every film like that is it's a team effort. It's yours, but I suppose as a director, I have to say, yeah, it's my film. I've directed it. It's there. There's no money as such that's going to be made off of that, unless you win a prize or something, you get some money from it. It's a passion project. It's there, and it's something that hopefully works as a calling card to what you can do. And I have to try and mix with that. That is for me and my career is where one element of where I'd like to go and what I'm doing. But then also I have to keep ticking over and I have to keep paying bills and I have to keep earning money and being able to fund and finance projects that I want to do by doing the paid ones. They tend to come from, for the first half of my sort of filmmaking career, I was the person putting in funding applications and getting funding in and instigating projects and things like that and organising them. And over the last half, I've been the person who's been brought onto projects to do things. Since I've been freelancing, it's more that. I'm looking at trying to go back to what, you know, starting projects and bringing people in for them. But the majority of the time I'm being, you know, there will be things that you find online, jobs that come up which you can apply for. But then there'll also be, you know, a base of clients that I've got that I've worked with before who will contact me and say, we've got another project. Can you give us a quote for this or for that? And it goes from there. So it's usually possibly the social conscious stuff, because a lot of those films are used quite a lot with youth work and schools and curriculums and things like that. So a film we made recently, which was called The Words We Don't Say, which was written and directed by a young filmmaker called Jess, that is being used to train young people of how to identify sexually coercive behaviour amongst themselves. So it's a really delicate subject matter, has to be treated right. Everybody on set had to be, you know, really carefully managed and supervised. It was written, performed and produced by young people. We monitored and looked after them. And now the film is out there and being used as a toolkit. Another film called Was Not Heard, which I directed and shot and was written by young people, is about youth voice and the importance of listening to it and the consequences of not listening to young people and creating good environments of communication. That's being used now. That was used by Public Health England for their online psychological first aid kit for people who are suffering mental health issues after COVID. So these things are commissioned and you create them. It was not heard. That was great. We had quite a lot of freedom with that, which was nice. But sometimes you're filming to, you know, really specific regimented remit and you put it out there and there it is. It's out in the world. But that tends to be the paid stuff is those sorts of films.
It seems like you do a lot with children and young people. Like, how has that happened? Is that...
Just, I suppose what it was one of the first things I did when I ran the community studios was a project came where I was working with young people, and I thought, well, it would be quite a good opportunity to get involved with, and it was an exciting project, and we did, and I had quite a lot of access of working with young people on it. I just really enjoyed it, and I thought, this is great. There's something like really kind of vibrant, I suppose, about it, which is really nice, that you're dealing with people who, you know, not my age, where you're just haggard and had enough of it, like, blimey, Riley, like, we've got to do this again. Like, they're really keen and enthusiastic and want to learn. And it's nice to get in at that point to work with people, because you can give them a really good start and a really good leg up. Because, you know, I've trod that road, you know, I've been down it, and I know what points I was there. You know, and I look back sometimes and I wish, God, I wish I'd known that, like, when I was 15 instead of when I was 25. So it's like, well, I can do that now. I can impart that knowledge and go, right, okay. Like, a good example is Jess. You know, I directed her in a film when she was 12, and there was something there. You could tell that this was somebody who was very film literate, very intelligent and savvy when it came to performance, but also to the process of making. So we got her to write things, and she's done really well. And, you know, she's about to go to university now. So it's like 7 years of working with her and producing her work and giving her advice when it comes to film. And she's in a position now that, you know, I'd love to be in that position. And she's just been unconditionally accepted to university to study film. I think she's the only person on the course to get that. But that's because she's got a portfolio, you know, 7 movies that are featured in over 100 festivals, won over 15, 20 awards, you know, and these opportunities are there. And I think you can offer that. It's really rewarding in itself. You know, once you've done it, you feel good about yourself, you know, by being able to help someone and offer them that opportunity. And also, one of the other things that you get from it is a different perspective. So, like, when I work with filmmakers, you know, adult sort of filmmakers, you're talking to them about their projects, there tends to be a formula and a formulaic sort of nature to things that, oh, I'm looking at this kind of story, I'm looking at this kind of idea. And, you know, as interesting and great as it is, you do tend to hear similar sounding things, whereas quite a lot of the films that you suggested I get from work with young filmmakers are like crazy, you know, and like, how on earth have you thought of, where did that come from? Why have you done that? And these sort of things sort of influence you a little bit. And, you know, it's different ways of thinking. You know, I thought of this by doing this or by doing that. And they're not formulaic yet. They are quite sporadic and different, and it encourages you and reminds you that actually making films is something that's supposed to be fun and enjoyable and a laugh. And really good, even if you're doing something really serious and stuff, at the end of it, you know, you should be celebrating what you've done. And you see a lot of that in young filmmakers when they're making stuff, and it's cool. So you learn stuff from them, and you can impart knowledge to them and hopefully give them a leg up as well.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the things that you're just doing for the passion then. So, like, how did you start about making short films, going to film festivals, and what have your experiences been with the kind of narrative shorts? I mean, you touched on it then, because you said you used Jess for one of those as well.
So I've made quite a lot of shorts It was quite interesting. I was talking to, again, producer yesterday, talking about when were you first happy with something you've made? You know, that's it. Because I think there's an initial period where you make something and you think, actually, yeah, okay, that's cool. And then about 6 months later, you look back and go, God, it's absolute terrible. It's awful film. What have I done? Why have I not shown anybody that again? And I think that's part of the process as you're learning and go forward. And as I mentioned with Jess, her first film, Coping, which is really good. And it's a lovely film. I think, you know, she's moved on from that, you know, now she's older, she's 7 years older, and there's quite a lot of change between 12 and 19 or 13 and 19 or whatever the ages were. And I think that doesn't kind of stop. I think you keep going through it. And I think probably only since the last sort of 7 years, the reason I can say it that accurately is I know the film is the things that I've made. I look back now and think, actually, I'm still okay with that. I'm all right with it. I'm happy with what we made there. You know, I know it sounds conceited and going like, oh, yeah, that's a great film. Well done, Keith. You've done brilliantly. But I think it's all right for you to be able to look back on your work and go, yeah, I like that. It's all right. It still stands up. And there's a film I made called Flawless, which I'd not made anything for a while. And we were running a filmmakers forum called 7.5 at the time. And a lot of time had gone into that and getting filmmakers to meet each other. And we used to have a pitching session and I pitched it. I got talking to an old friend called Jim, and he's a sci-fi writer, and we started writing this thing, but it's based around a female character. So we recognized that we needed a female voice as well in the creative process, and invited a friend called Lucy over to work with us. And Lucy was really the key to unlocking it. And we made this film, which was about time travel. It's about a girl who is a genius sat on a bench with her dad going through a time puzzle. Dad asks her to fix a watch, and at the same time you see this woman walking through a village, through a city centre. Two stories combined where we find out at the same time, and the woman is travelling back in time to save her father from getting by a car that day. So she's saving the life of her dad. With everybody on, like, we're tapping into something, and we did some test screenings of it. And we got amazing feedback saying that, you know, you should put this out there. And I'd encourage that with anybody, because to save money, you know, going into the festival circuit of test screen stuff and see what people think. And acid test it, be honest with yourself. If it's working, great. If it's not, then maybe keep it back and save your money for the next one. And we got good feedback, so we went for it. And I think there's also, you know, I spoke earlier on about that phone call with when I was working at the Mercury. There's an element of that when it comes to the festivals that, you know, the first festival I submitted Flawless to, it got selected. And it was like, wow. You know, previously this, I'd shown in different places, but this was a concerted effort. This is like, right, we're trying to build towards something now. And this is the first film. This is the first element of it. Let's see if we're getting things right. And it was Cine Fiesta in Puerto Rico. That was it. They said, yeah. And they accepted it. And it was like, it is like the coolest thing you get, like either the film freeway email or something, judge's status has changed and it's selected and it's there. That's just cool. I love it. And Flawless was the first film that really did that. We made another film called Dolls and that took off as well. They both were in about 25 festivals each, got in some BAFTA and BAFTA qualifiers, and which was really, really cool. At the same time, producing and helping young people make stuff, and we got obviously Jess with she made a film called Girl A, which got into about 45 festivals and won countless awards, like, and has done really well. And it's sort of the pattern and the way that we were working seemed to be working, and the stories we were telling and the techniques we were using seemed to be hitting home, and learning more and more about festivals. Actually, I do workshops on festivals and things, and like anybody, we're always learning something this week about actually Aesthetica sent an email out about the future of festivals and how they could be now more of a combined online and physical festival sort of thing. And how we respond to that is changing all the time. So we're aware of the films we're making, but also we're adding to them as well and trying to find different elements. The film we've just finished actually called Lifelike, which I mentioned, we produced that during COVID lockdown and made it. In like the 3 week period where Leicester could actually go out and share a space with six people. So we made that our angle. You know, here's the film which we feel is well written and well produced, but also there's a little angle to it as well, which is we made it like this and we had to do all of these things. And I think festivals like those sorts of things. So it's good to have, you've got to have a good story, you've got to have a good film, well made, but also having a little bit of extra, as if somebody I worked with before, he calls it pepper. I think actually got a little bit of pepper on the side of it. It's really nice to the film. It gives it an edge and gets festivals to select. So over the last sort of 7 years, Flawless and Dolls and Lifelike and Double Word Score are four films which I've made, which have done all right at festivals. And it's good for your reputation. And also as we move forward and look towards theatre, hopefully, that hopefully proves to people that, you know, you're a wise investment. Invest in us, you know, we make good stuff.
So how do you feel about festivals generally? Because you mentioned that it can be expensive to get them in, you should like test things and get them free. But like, what is the experience like? What do you think the kind of value of festivals is? I'm thinking especially because there are so many of them as well.
Yeah. I think they're hugely valuable. I think they're great. I love going to them. I'd say that if you enter a festival, then you should do it because it's going to forward you. You know, if you get selected for it, then it's going to forward you in some way as a filmmaker. Now, that could be, if it's the first time you've ever entered anything, that could be any festival, because it's going to forward you because it's such a great experience to be selected and that affirmation that comes with it. That's brilliant. But I think as you move forward, you probably tend to have to be a bit more selective in what you're submitting to, just to, you know, because why am I going to pay that festival 10 quid if I, you know, it's not really doing anything or proving anything to me at that point, when actually that £10 I could have saved for my next film or for another festival or whatever. So I think you sort of have to question why you're submitting to something and what you're going to gain from it. It's not necessarily size or reputation either. There have been festivals that I've been to that are really small, that are just the most vibrant and brilliant places to go, and they're confidence boosting, and that's really good. So getting selected and then talking about your film and getting some, you know, credit for it, mental health wise and stuff, is fantastic. But the you know, the networking opportunities are great. Meeting other filmmakers, fantastic. A really good example, actually, went to the Rob Knox Film Festival in London, which is really, really great. It's in memory of an actor, a young actor called Rob Knox, who was sadly stabbed and died. He was in the Harry Potter movies, and his family set up the festival to provide screening opportunities and filming workshops and things for young people. And working with Jess again on that show, a film called Hidden that was on, and another filmmaker was there, older filmmaker came over and networked with her and gave her encouragement and stuff, which is just like invaluable. And I've had that myself, you know, where you sat and you talk to somebody, watch your work, and they go, you know, I love that. I thought it's fantastic. It's really, really good. And that's invaluable to you, you know, that confidence to carry on, that you're doing the right thing. I think it's great. On the flip side of that, it's awesome as well to get people come up to you and say, like, you know, I didn't get that. You know, what was that? And you explain it and you go through it. And I've had people sort of criticize films I've made or have produced. And sometimes you can talk to them about that. And I think that's they're the more important ones to talk to than the ones that really like it, because that's probably an ego massage, where the other one is a challenge, and you need to know why the audience didn't like things. It's probably the most important relationship you have as a filmmaker is with your audience. So being at festivals and talking to people there are great. It can forward you career-wise. You know, if you get selected for something like Rain Dance or Aesthetica or Encounters, then you're doing something right, and that should prove to funders that this person's doing well. You just need to, it's the approach that you take that you've got to be careful. I'd advise, you know, dipping your toe into about, give yourself a target, say 20 festivals. I'm gonna enter 20 festivals, research those festivals, have a look at what they've shown before, have a look at their status. Are they BAFTA qualifiers, or is it just a little district festival or somewhere in between? Get a selection of those, submit to those 20, you know, stick to an amount of money you're gonna spend, and then give yourself a target. If you say, right, if I hit 5 of those, I'm going to do another 20. And if you don't, then be strict and don't submit to anything else and stop. You know, if that's your cutoff point, you don't reach it, stop, save your money, move on to the next film and do that. You know, hopefully you get a taste at the start of what's going to select it and what's not. And that should guide you in how much you spend. But they can be expensive, but in the right techniques and the right way of looking at it, you can save money. And I think they do a great thing for your career and your self-confidence.
You mentioned there about trying to attract investors. So with your short films going out to festivals and like BAFTA qualifying festivals as well, some of them, is your aim now to try and get a feature off the ground and like get people to invest in that? I'm just kind of thinking about what you've said.
It's the start of that process, really, of looking into it. We're currently putting together a funding application to the BFI, which we hope to put in, which, you know, hopefully we're successful. Hopefully we make a successful film. Hopefully that can be combined then with our track record and what we've done and, you know, the intentions of where we want or where I want to go and what I want to be, you know, career-wise. And that if I can pull that together, then, you know, hopefully that means that there will be investment and there will be things that we can attract towards it. The first part, I think, is I've been quite good at doing. So we've managed to be successful with films and we've got sort of a good proven track record of what we've made. We make things professionally and safely. And now it's just a matter of, you know, jumping into the next part of the stage and the process, which is hopefully getting a short funded, which then we can encourage funding afterwards to either extend that into feature or other ideas that we've got that might be a little more related to it that could be feature. And that's the route that we're going to go down, or I'm going to go down. There are other ways, obviously, you know, of getting money in and funding in and that sort of thing. But that's the sort of way I find probably the most appealing, or maybe probably the most relevant for me, I think.
So do you know who you would approach for financing? Like, would it depend on what the film was, or like what's...
At the moment, yeah, it's the BFI network funding that we would go for. There's the short film funding that they do, which we're finalising our funding bit. I should have done it a long time ago, but it's been going for a while. I just, with work, it's finding the time to be able to do it, and now I've got a bit of time to do it. It's right, okay, now's the time to jump in and see if we can get some funding in for it. So that's where we're going.
So have the shorts you've made already been just self-funded, or have you raised money in other ways?
No, self-funded. So like if I can, you know, get a project in through my work, you know, through that arm of what I do, then I can start to use money there to produce something. Some things have been collaborative and we've worked together in collaboration. Some things have been paid and it's a variety of different things, really. So far, mostly self-funded. There's been no funding from organisations or, you know, sort of Kickstarters or things like that. Not done that yet. It's something I may well do and look at, but so far, self-funded or collaborative.
I think it's strange because people think about filmmaking as this like, oh, it's a way to like make loads of money. But I don't know about your experience in mine, like making films costs money. Like you get a lot out of the experience, but making money back from it is rare for short films.
Yeah, I mean, there's an old rule, I think, of short films, which was make it, but be aware that average audience member is going to watch it once and that's it. And therefore, how are you going to earn money from that and do things? Unless you're making something that is connected to some form of, I'm thinking of things like BMW shorts and stuff like that, where it's connected to a company and it goes out that way. They're calling cards. It's the cliche way of describing it because everybody sort of, I've said it so many times, people go, it's a calling card that could lead to something else. But, you know, if you're looking to make money, then this isn't the way to go. But if you were looking to start a career, then this is the way to go, if that's the career you want to go into. I think they're calling cards. You're not going to make money off of shorts, usually.
How do you feel about distribution of shorts? Because there are, like, channels out there that just show shorts, but then I feel like there's also, okay, do I just stick it on YouTube and let everyone see it? Or do I put... Because you can put things on Amazon Prime and you can charge for them. There's other channels that you can charge for. Like, how do you feel about distribution of shorts?
I think I really like what's happened over sort of the last 5 to 10 years and how things have changed. I'm a big advocate for celebrating your work and the life of your short after you've finished it. That quite often, I think, particularly where we were working in Leicester, that people make stuff and they just put it on YouTube, which is going to drown on YouTube. You know, the content that is measurable every day that's going on it. So why would anybody look at yours? Unless you can place it in the film, I think, once you've finished it. And again, as part of workshops, I talk about this at festivals. Obviously, festivals is one. When you're distributing it, you can screen it yourself and put it on. And we've collected shorts together before where three or four filmmakers making something at the same time. Well, let's do a screening. Let's get everybody together and put it on the screen and get people to talk about it. You can create buzz that way. Once you finish your festivals run and have done that, you know, there are things like video on demand and things. So, you know, getting a genre-specific YouTube channel or something. So lots of horror ones are now and sci-fi and things like that. So you might get some exposure by distributing it that way. There are quite a lot of niche channels now as well. With Hidden, the film I mentioned earlier on, which features a same-sex female couple, we were approached by a channel which is really starting to grow now called Lesflix, which deals with lesbian film and screens solely lesbian film.
Did they find you off the back of festivals?
They found off the back of festivals and that it had been out there and people were aware of it and contacted us and said, we really like your film. Would you like us to, you know, to distribute and put it on there? And the film has finished its run now. We've got the forms and we're going through that process of putting it on there, be a paid platform. There's a split of money. So that's great. You know, if money comes in, then that money can be invested into the next project. I know friends who have had things on Amazon and on Prime and on Netflix, and they've earned money from that, which is really, really good. I think once you've done that, you know, the opportunity then is just to then put it on Vimeo after. It's going to end up there anyway, or YouTube. Put it on there, but you've got so many other things that you can do in between. Another way that I've done before is making films that have might match a charity or an organisation. So I produced a film with young filmmakers called Charlie's Diary, which was written and produced by young people looking at a young person questioning gender and what they were. It's a sort of inner monologue of a child who was being bullied because they became appeared effeminate. But were also then supported by a group of people because they recognised that they were questioning something and tried to give them a safe space. Really nicely done. They hit the mark. They did their research, hit the mark. It was good. And we just contacted a group called Mermaids, which is the a charity for working with young people and gender issues. And we just said, would you like the film and use it? And they said, yeah, it'd be great. So then they took it and they use it. And there's another audience, you know, there's your film. You can look at it, do it for the really noble and good reasons of wanting to help people, which is great, and that's why we do it. But off the side of that, you know, you've got another audience and more people are seeing it and your film has a different life.
Do they buy that from you? Do they have the rights now?
Or no, we gave it.
That's different. Oh, you just gave it to them. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of, I mean, I think with charities, I wouldn't sell anything. But with an organisation, you know, it might be a sports organisation or something like that, or that you think actually this film's got some form of connection to you. Would you like to use it? You might want to purchase it or whatever. Yeah. You could broker something like that, but certainly with charities, it's always free.
Yeah. It seems to you like the biggest thing is just kind of like getting your name out there and having people like know what you can do. So, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to ask is like, what's your kind of like ultimate career goal? Are you always going to like make your own stuff, or are you hoping someone will just go like, oh, can we get you to do this big, massive production for us? I mean, like, what's?
I think it is getting your name out there. I mean that's just business, and being able to pay bills and do my job, and you know, keep my daughter in clothes and in school, you know, things like that. It's and fed. So you have to put it out there. And social media is probably my main outlet of letting people know things through Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and stuff. And I don't really post anything personal on social media, but I will put all my work on there and channel it through there and do all of that. And getting your name out there means that I do get considered for work and for jobs and for things. And whenever, you know, if there's a success, people see that, and that will hopefully attract people to go, well, they kind of know what they're doing. I'll come and ask them for this. Would you like to do this job? Would you like to do that? And we do get that. And that social media side of things for me is really important. I do get a lot of work through it by putting name out there, getting people to know who you are. And that's the bill paying work. But also there's a lot that happens when it comes to the personal projects as well. And you get, you know, we've been lucky enough to once or twice now be invited to festivals rather than submit. They've asked for our work, and it's like, oh, well, that's great. You know, we're not even submitting that now. Yeah, they've asked for that to happen, but that only comes from, you know, publicising it and getting it out there and trying to get your name out there. And the goal to it is, I mean, personally, I've always wanted to make a feature. I want to make a feature. And I know, I mean, I'm 44 now, and, you know, a lot of people go, why haven't you made one by now? You know, you should have done it by now. You know, and no, we all have our different paths. And to be fair, I just don't think that I felt like I was in the right position or the right, I wasn't refined enough as my job to be able to do it. And I felt I needed to improve more before I could tackle that. And now I feel like, yeah, I am kind of in that right place now for it, and I'm going to go do it. And that's my personal goal, what I want to do. But connected to that are other ones, which is, you know, I want to see the young people that I work with, I want to see where they can go. And that's going to be really interesting, watching where they go within the industry and if they can get into industry and what differences they can make and what films they can do as well. So it's quite nice having several things you'd like to do, which is good, and not just one thing, because if it doesn't happen, then you're going to be a bit, you know, upset by that. So personally, I want to go make a feature, but also I'd really like to see the people I work with do well as well.
Let's talk about that a bit then. It seems like you're teaching various different courses. How did you get all of those? Like, how did you get all these jobs?
Again, putting your name out there, you know, letting people know you do what you do. I've been really lucky to work with Leicester Youth Service quite a lot of times, and to the point of making films that have had national recognition and things, and through combined work. That's the thing. It's the great thing of working with them is if that really is combined. I, you know, my skills as a filmmaker, their skills as youth workers, and the young people's skills as creatives and hearing their voice and listening to what they do. And that's been superb, because you learn so much from youth work, seeing of how to teach, how to get through to young people, how not to be, you know, just that person stood at the front of the class talking that nobody's listening to, but hopefully actually engaging and caring about as well, you know, and listening attentively and understanding how that's done. Has been a great aid to me, and working with them for probably about 10, 15 years has helped me to then teach young people, but also adults as well, and that sort of thing. And I try to make what teaching is as lighthearted as possible, as relaxed as possible, and try and make it interactive as well, you know, get people talking and things rather than just me stood talking. So, yeah, I really like it. I really enjoy it. I don't want it to be too much, you know, because like I say, filmmaker that teaches. But yeah, it's cool. It's just getting your name out there. People will hear about it, ask you to come and teach something. I recently started work with Art Speak in Nottingham, working with over 60s in independent living, which has been really cool. They've got some really good ideas, and looking forward to producing those with them. Some have already started on some documentaries that they're making. And that came through finding a job on Arts Jobs. And just applying for it, but being able to go, look, teaching wise, I do all these things, like, you know, and it gives you obviously that long CV helps you out. The jobs with the unis, I got a really good word put in for me by a fellow filmmaker at one, and the other one was they were desperate and didn't have anybody, and gave me a call, and another filmmaker a call, and we're like, yeah, okay, so we sorted it all out, and I've been there since. So again, I think it's probably because they knew where I taught and what I was doing. That social media side of things is great. I mean, I've been in business for 11 years. I've never had a website, and I'm a filmmaker. I should really have one. But you know, by getting yourself out there and like you said, like networking and talking to people and working with lots and lots of different people, they become aware of your work and what you do. So it's cool. You know, say if on like a young person's film shoot and we organize it together, it could be anywhere up to 30 or 40 young people involved in that project. Well, that's 30 or 40 young people will talk to their mums and their dads, and their mums and their dads will talk to somebody. 6 degrees of separation. They know somebody somewhere who teaches, and they go, there it is. And being a filmmaker, it's kind of niche. So especially in lockdown, I witnessed a real uptick in teaching. But I think that was probably because people were isolated and wanted to do something interesting. And hopefully, you know, filmmaking is interesting. So we got an opportunity to do a lot of teaching online with people and give them something interesting to do while they were stuck at home. So yeah, lots of different teaching, lots of different ways into it, really. Yeah,
and I think through your teaching, well, you've already mentioned, you know, Jess and working with other kids, it's like, you know, you will also make links? Like, I suppose you'll get a sense of like, okay, this person's really into it, whereas this person's just passing the time. Like, I guess you can recognize that from how they are when you're teaching them.
Yeah, that's really tricky. Because you can't like waste your time, you know, with someone who doesn't take it seriously or isn't really bothered. You hope that you're working with young people who artistically are switched on. Now, I'm not going to delude myself and think that every young person I work with and is going to become a filmmaker or is going to work in the industry. But what it might do is actually contribute to where they do go and what they do and how it builds them and helps them to get to the career they want to get to. So you have to kind of gauge it. And it's really hard like you do get a sense sometimes from certain young people when they're writing stuff. I'm working with a few at the moment. So Molly and Yaz on two films that are about knife crime, both extremely artistic, both extremely talented and dedicated, hardworking. And that's great. You know, this is the same way, is it, that hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard? Well, they've got that. They've got the talent and they've got the work element to it as well, which is kind of the graft side of it. Is if you don't see it, then that's it. One thing I would put in place with young people I've done before is we set deadlines, but the deadlines are always done through negotiation. So it might be, right, you've handed your first draft in, okay, here are your notes, how long do you think it will take for you to do a second draft? And they can go, right, it'll take 2 weeks. Like, you sure you've got class and everything, and talk to them, 2 weeks realistic? Yes, it's realistic. Okay, then there it is, that's your deadline there, don't miss it or the project stops. And that, you know, can't teach in the film industry young people that missing deadlines is kind of okay or whatever. So whether we're on the final edit or we're on the first draft of the script, you miss the deadline, we stop and it's done. And yeah, don't that's it. So if you don't work hard or you can't meet those deadlines, then we stop. And so far, so good. Their response is great to it. They hit their deadlines. Usually they're early because they want to get the ball right. I want to get things made. I want to get stuff done, you know. Jess emailed over a new draft for a script recently, and I'm already getting it in the ear, going like, you know, have you read the script yet? Where's it got? Well, you got your notes yet? Where, come on, you know, where is it? You're like, yeah, okay, I'll get there. So, you know, that's great to see. It's proof that they're the people that you should be working with.
And I've kind of watched a couple of your shorts and it seems like you do get a lot of people involved. Like, how do you go about getting the band together, like finding your crew, finding your actors? Like, is it all connections you have, or do you use some of the platforms to kind of find people to collaborate with?
I've been very lucky. When we ran the film forum, 7.5, we had a lot of people came in and accessed that, and I was the chair of it. So I talked to a lot of people and met a lot of people and met very really talented and really dedicated people, which has been very lucky for me to be able to tap into. I do like to choose rather than cast or put out mail outs. And there are people that I think I've got quite a specific way of working. I like things to be quite relaxed, quite laid back, non-stressful, but also person needs to be good as well. It's finding that mix. I think it's as important how good somebody is as to how you're going to work with them. Do you get on with them? And there are people who I know and I've worked with a lot that I love to go back and work with again, so I'll choose them. And I do the same with acting as well, is I try to choose people and go, rather than cast and bring in a lot of people, it'll be like, I like that person, can we get them? And then we find a way to do that, and it might be done through their agent, it might be done by just contacting them directly. They might not even be an actor, but they're on Flawless. Jess was learning acting, but Fergus, who acted alongside, was a stand-up comedian. But you know, there were transferable skills there, and he was really dedicated to what he did and got into it and did a fantastic job. So lots of different ways, really, but most of it is by selecting and choosing and putting that crew together. I just like that element. And sometimes when you go, oh, if you'd have put it out there, you might have got somebody with better kit or things like that. I say, yeah, but I really enjoyed working with them. And the quality of the film is really important, obviously, but also the experience of making it is really important. I think you get the right team together, you love doing it, and you want to do it again. You know, if you work on a set where it's like really pressurized and everybody's stressed and it's running over time and everybody hates everybody, why on earth would you want to do that again? I made a decision when I was very young, which is like, you know, I worked out that like 8-9 hours a day you're working, I don't want to do a job I don't like. Like, if that's going to be the majority of my life, then why would I do that? You know, I don't want to do that. I want to do something I love. So why would I create a stressful situation on set by selecting the wrong people? So choosing and selecting and finding them is key. But I've been very lucky to meet a lot of filmmakers. But again, like, festivals, going to festivals, talking to people, meeting people. I'm part of BAFTA crew, which is really good. And we've done some film tasks on there. And that's where Lifelike and Double Word Score have come from, by meeting extremely talented people there and being able to work with them and make things. So there's lots of different places, but I do like selecting.
And what kind of crew size do you like to work with? Because you can make a film on any scale.
Usually quite small, quite intimate sort of thing. Lifelike, obviously that's different because that was in lockdown. There was three of us. So I directed and did second camera. Charlie was the DOP and first camera, and Jason was the sound operator. And then we got Michael, who was the actor. So four of us in total, three of us on crew, all doubling up and doing lots of different jobs. But we had to do it that way. Something like, Dolls, that was me and Jesse's Morton. There's two of us who did that. But then Flawless, we had about seven or eight on crew. So camera ops, sound ops, runners, producer, myself, AD, bit of security as well. It's okay going up over that. It's fine. I've worked with much bigger crews. Usually I've produced with bigger crews as well. But I do like to not have too many people around. You know, it's sort of, I think it helps the performance, you know, to try and to restrict it a little bit. We've got so many people around, it makes it very difficult for actors sometimes to really get into it. So probably smaller side.
And when you've worked with certain actors, do you find yourself writing with them in mind?
Probably not, actually. I've seen it done. The last two films have been written by somebody else. So for it, like Lifelike was, I really wanted to work with Michael because he's a brilliant actor. He's really, really good. And everything I'd seen him in, I thought, yeah, this guy's great. I'd love to work with Michael. And bumped into each other a lot from regional circuits and things like that.
He's also just a top bloke. Like, he's, you know,
he is. Yeah, yeah, he's the nicest guy. Yeah. He's the nicest guy. And that was nice. And I sent him the script and, do you fancy doing this? And he was up for it. And yeah, that was cool. What was the question again?
I don't know. I just record these things.
I've just got lost in my admiration for Michael. That's it. There you go.
I was asking.
Oh no, writing your mind. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. So that was more like I wanted to work with Michael and get him in. No, I've never wrote with anybody in mind. I've written stuff and then thought I'd like that person. So at the moment we're writing a script, and I know that I can visualize, but I can visualize the person, the character. I couldn't tell you the actor yet. It'll come, I think. But I can see them. I know what age they are and what they do and what they look like, that sort of thing. But I don't quite know fully. They're not fully formed yet. So, yeah.
I suppose I've got the same question, but with locations. Like, do you write with limitations in mind, or do you write and then worry about it?
I think certainly because we're working in an independent industry, you have to sometimes write with location in mind. You know, if I write something that's based on a ballroom on a Zeppelin on Mars, like how on earth am I going to afford it? You know, it's huge budget constraints to that, maybe. But if I write something that's based, you know, within houses and school or on the street or in a park or in a field and things like that, you start, you know, okay, that's more manageable. I think that's doable. And you certainly, it's one of those restrictions though, you know, with studio and independence, you know, studio filming, you've got all the budget, you can do whatever you like. Great. Independent film, you've got your restrictions. But alternatively, you know, you look at studio films, you know, kind of Walt Disney movie, throw in a dead body at the end. No, you know, I can, because I'm in India, I've got that freedom to do it. Yeah. So there are, you know, payoffs for the restrictions. But I do think sometimes about, you know, I can't really base that there. I was thinking about it today. I've got a sequence where the character's in a car driving and talking over the hands-free. It's like, can I afford the truck and the trailer and the car? And can we afford that? Oh, you know, got to try and budget for it. So even things like that, you know, thinking about it.
Well, there's the green screen way, like wrap something around it and then feel, ah, it's awkward. Like,
yeah, there is. I just prefer getting stuff real. And it to be, yeah, that's, well, it's kind of not real as well because they're not driving. So, but yeah, we'll see our way around that. I'll talk to the producer.
It's fun to see that one from the outside. Like if you see cars being dragged along with trailers, it's amusing.
Yeah, we did it a while ago. It was pretty cool. It was we've done it with different. I've done it with the sucker cup tripods as well, where you stick it on the bonnet and then turn the sucker cups and stick it to the bonnet and that sort of thing. And then done it as well where there's rigs and trailers and stuff. And yeah, it is cool. Yeah.
Okay, I'll just ask you a couple more then. I think we've covered loads. I'm just looking at the time. I was like, oh, normally I talk for ages, but I've got everything. Let's go right to the beginning then. So like, what possessed you as a kid to think, right, I want to make films, and what was your kind of plan to go about it? Like, was there...
I get asked this quite a lot actually, and it's nice to talk about, because my first sort of real touch point with films is watching films on a Sunday with my mum. And she'd sit down and watch all the epics and sword and sandal epics and things like that. So there are films that I remember from when I was, you know, 8 or 9 years old on a Sunday afternoon that she would probably fall asleep to about an hour and a half in. But things like Ben-Hur and Spartacus, but also things like The Vikings with Tony Curtis and Kirk Douglas and films like that. And she used to love watching those and telling me what the story was about as it was happening. And I really remember that and films sticking with me. And the second point I think about when I was younger was when I was about 13 or 14, and a friend of mine, Michael, he asked me, like, sort of like, is it something along the lines of, what's the name of the guy who gets hung from a helicopter in Scarface? I said, oh, he's called F. Murray Abraham. And he said, you know loads about people's names in films and things. You should do something with that. And I thought, yeah, I probably should, actually. And I met another friend called Scott. And Scott had, like, the vastest, like, film collection I've ever seen. And so, like, I want a bit of that. I want to learn more about that. I want to get more of that. So I started buying films and watching them and buying books about them. And by the time I got to A-levels, I really wanted to do film. It didn't exist. Communications was the name of the module that you would do, which is probably like a forerunner for media and media studies. But I got talked out of it by my careers advisor, which was good of him. And I did history, which I'd enjoyed at GCSE and hated at A-level. But when it got to university, it was like, right, film. Film's what I want to do. I'm going there and I'm doing it. I went to Wolverhampton, studied film theory and practice there. I think it's really important that you've got theory alongside practice. You need to know, yes, you need to know how to switch it on and make it work and do all the amazing things it can do, but you need to know why you're doing that as well. And studied there. And it went from that point forward. So the youngest points really are those. My mum, my mate Mike, my mate Scott, and they sort of, you know, rumbled me on until I could get to uni and then let's go make stuff.
I think one of the biggest stumbling blocks, and you probably find this with a kid you teach as well, is just like people seeing it as a viable career, like people believing it's an option.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I've seen that with parents of some children I've worked with, but I've also seen extraordinarily supportive parents as well. Who recognise, you know, the passion that they've got for it and want to follow it up and do it, and they support them brilliantly. You know, some parents don't feel that way.
So what are some of the things you've mentioned about making a feature, but like, what are some of the things that you feel that you really have to do that you haven't managed to do yet in your filmmaking career?
It's a good question. I don't know. So I got asked yesterday, I probably have to give it context, because the person said, you know, at your age, is there anything left that you still want to do? We had literally we had literally just been talking about how old we all were, and I was by far the oldest at the table. So, I think at that point I said, yeah, no, I want to make feature, obviously, and things like that. I can't really look. More features, you know, and that sort of thing, and produce other people's work and help them to do that as well. Really look much further than that. I just always wanted to make films and make feature films, and and get things into cinemas and audiences and make films that make a difference to people. Certainly want to, you know, I've made films that I aren't really, what's it without sounding like a total dick, really, of going that it's not like a life-changing movie or whatever, not that anything you've made is, but something that's going to have an influence, something that is saying something, you know, about an issue or something like that. I've always wanted to make things like that rather than stuff that is a bit more throwaway and that sort of thing. But I've got a lot of time for that. So yeah, I've made stuff that, you know, is just for a laugh and that sort of things. And those things are really good fun to get involved in. And but I like things that have a bit of a message to them, have something underneath them that are, have got substance and stuff. So just to continue making those, really, or get a chance to make those, that's the main thing.
Actually, I've not really touched on that, and it's true that you do a lot of those kind of films. So would you, I mean, are you equally interested in making the more documentary type films, or is it narrative that you'd want to be focusing on?
I like things to be as real as they can, even when, like, Lifelike is a drama, and it's got some messages in there which are really nice. And I like the messages that involve that are about interaction with technology and loneliness and things like that, which are quite cool. I like that. And it's got weight, a little bit of weight to it, which is nice. But then, you know, I could look back at, say, Flawless, which I think is much more emotional. It meant a lot. That was a lot of emotion invested in that. It related to things that had happened around the time that were really quite difficult to get through. And it felt like a lot more had been put into that. And I'd hoped that it had that emotion to it, which was very lucky enough to have people tell me that they felt that it had it and affected them. And you know, the whole thing was about wanting to meet someone who died. And we talked about not going back in time, but moving sideways and having a moment just to see them or something like that would be amazing and wonderful. And I was very lucky that a friend of mine who a mutual friend had passed away very recently to it, then, and the parent of the person who passed away said, "You've nailed it. That's how I felt. That's what I wanted." And he went, "Well, if it hit you, then that's enough. That's good. I can rest with that one and I'm happy with it." And there's a lot invested in that. But I do like, you know, with Lifelike, it wasn't as emotionally invested in it. There's a lot invested in it through time and effort and working hard to make something really good and be dedicated and truthful to what the story is and those sorts of things. And there's no less effort that goes into it. And there's no less skill. At the end of it, I wasn't like a shell, like with Flawless. I was like, there's nothing left. I need a week off, you know, or so, you know, I need time off. With Lifelike, it was very, really enjoyable to make. It's got some message in there. We worked really hard at it and we're proud of what we made and it's cool. And I can make things like that and that I could do those all the time. And I love making them. Yeah, I think on the whole, it's saying I love making films like Lifelike where we worked really hard and we're dedicated to it. And we put a lot of effort in and a lot of, you know, graft and hard work and skill goes into those things. Occasionally a film will come along where you know it's going to drain you and take a lot out of you. And possibly the one I'm working on at the moment because I've experienced it and I've seen it and it's a topic that's made me angry, you know, and I want to make something about it, you know, rather than sit there and being an armchair warrior and sitting there going, "Oh, this is terrible," and doing nothing. You know, you think, what do I do? You know, what if there is something out there, a subject matter or something out there that you think, actually, I don't like that, or I like that, or that's great and nobody knows, or that's awful and people should know about it, then do something about it. You know, if you're, whatever your skill is or whatever your abilities are, then go do something. And I'm a filmmaker, so I'm going to make a film about it. And that's sort of where I'm at, really. The nuance about youth work, the degradation of youth work and the cost of it, you know, both personally but up to people, but also through the service and the effects it has on young people and stuff. So is awful what's, you know, what the positions that youth workers and things are put in at the moment. So looking at that, I know this project's going to be quite a hefty one. There are projects you can manage more. This one feels like it's going to be a bit more of an emotional investment as much as a time and hard work and graft and, you know, as well. So yeah, I do like making them. I like things with messages. That's what I like. So yeah.
It seems like that applies to both your kind of narrative and your more, I don't know, like documentary is the wrong word, like investigation films? I don't know, like what would you call
kind them? Of, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, they're a little bit like that. So, you know, how do you define was not heard, which is, you know, children talking about how they feel when it's not, when they're not listened to, just mixed with images of them doing things that they love doing. So, you know, we put it in for the documentary section at Aesthetica and Portobello, and it got selected at Portobello, got nominated for Best Documentary as well. So it's kind of a, maybe a modern interpretation of a documentary, maybe, or an experimental documentary. Yeah, there's a few things like that. Wasn't Heard's a good example of it.
So is it important to you that your films are saying something, like that they have kind of an opinion or that they make people think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've done straight up genre filmmaking, which I like Dolls is just a straight up horror. There's no message to Dolls, other than, you know, don't be a dicky little brother. It's just a straight up horror designed to make people jump and then have a bit of a laugh at the end. There's no message there, but he loved making it. It was really good making it, really good getting it out there and people enjoying it. Just really, really cool. But I do get more out of some, for me, trying to communicate a message to someone and they get it. And I think with film, you know, a lot of it is subtext. You're trying to get something into people subconsciously about the topic that you're looking at, as well as visibly on the screen, it being there, also trying to control the messages that are running in the undercurrents of your film, which are important to get across. You know, Lifelike has a very subtle, it's subtle to some, but not to others, moment where the story turns on its head. And some people, the vast majority of people I know have got it and gone, oh, no, you know, that's happened. But then some people have gone, oh, so what was that at the end? You know, you've got to be willing to accept that as a filmmaker, that some people are going to get the messages of your film and some aren't. That's fine. It's okay. It doesn't mean it's a bad film. It doesn't mean that they're not, you know, a smart and astute audience member. It just means that you two didn't hit on that point. You know, you just didn't meet on this film and that's it. So, yeah, I think it's whatever that message may be, you know, Flawless is about, it's about grief and loss, but also the want to talk to someone, and but also that I suppose we get down to it is it's okay because we're sharing, and I'm saying that I've experienced this, and hopefully I've put it down and you feel that you've experienced this as well, and we share something, and that's what Flawless was about, was that, you know, the fact that we're sharing, the fact that we're not on our own when you're going through grief in that way and loss. You know, like you say, Dolls is about nothing, and Lifelike is about loneliness and about interaction with technology. So interaction with technology, you can get very frustrated with Lifelike. Loneliness, you can feel really sad for the person as well. And we had a really good reaction to, showed the film to some, we did a workshop, a directing workshop, and at the start we showed people something I've made so they can see, like, oh, right, that's the kind of thing you do. And I showed them that, and they were watching it, and I could see all their faces on the Zoom box, and then the moment drops where the sort of the twist comes, and this guy's face just, he was like, oh, his mouth dropped. It was like, oh, great, it's hit home, fantastic. And then I found out that they too knew Michael, and so it hit them twice as hard because they were going, like, oh, no, poor Michael. Like, you know. So, yeah, okay. But, yeah, messages, definitely getting something across to people, touching people in that way, you know, you've made that connection. And with an audience, and that's fantastic. Just that link between you and them, and you've connected is brilliant. One of the best things I ever saw at film screening, it's a very simple thing. It was at the Leicester International Film Festival way back in 2003, and a filmmaker called Kevin, who I knew, made an experimental film of a guy just drawing circles on paper and getting quicker and quicker and looking out the window at this paper mache moon, and it's very black, it's black and white, very abstract film. But it increased in pace, and the circles were getting quicker, and the pencil was quicker and louder, sharpening his pencil with a knife. And then eventually the knife slips off the pencil into his thumb. And the timing that he got of it and what he did, the entire audience, about 220 people, all at the same time went like that. And it was amazing. And I was part of the audience and I did the same. And we were all sort of like, and then he stopped, put his paper down and started to draw circles again really, really quietly. And then it slowed down, the camera pulled out and went out of the window, and off it went. Now, I don't, you know, what message is being communicated in that film, I don't know, but the connection he'd made to get everybody to do that at the same time, like, that is, well, and I saw him afterwards, like, that must have been a buzz when that happened. It was like, he said, I kind of was hoping I might get a good reaction, but I didn't expect it to be like everybody at the same time, you know. It was brilliant. And that meant it connected, you know, it got the connection there with them. And that comes with messages sometimes, it comes with visuals. So I think, you know, somebody comes out to you and says, oh, I got that, and it really meant something to me, or that was really cool, and or I felt really sad for that character, or like, you know, good, because that's what I was trying to communicate, and I'm glad you got it.
And I do think with films, like, some things do just hit you on a subconscious level, and they may or may not have been intended to be that way, but it's just, there's kind of a reaction to it that's kind of, it's, I don't know, it's on a different level to thinking about it. So, like, it's feeling, I suppose, or...
Yeah. I mean, that's probably it. You know, that's you think you've nailed it there, is that it's about making people feel something. You know, if you can, you know, when teaching audience expectationship and looking at audience expectation, how audiences respond, I think it's and things like mise-en-scene and language of the camera and how the angles and the composition and sound and everything are talking to you. It's really important to take a step back before you delve into it, I think, and understand how we operate as human beings. And, you know, about 95% of our decisions every day are subconscious and a very small percentage are conscious. So that's sort of where you need to exist as a filmmaker, is in that sort of ether of literally, here's my film, here's my story, which I know you're going to get, and consciously you're looking at and watching and understanding, hopefully, and making decisions. But also subconsciously, I'm going to get into you with, and make you feel certain things with the camera angles and the, you know, all of that sort of stuff is important to understand how you can manipulate your audience, how you can get them to be, and how you can make them feel. You know, there's a great response I had from a student once when I showed them a clip from The Empire Strikes Back with the fight between Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker, and Luke Skywalker's shot from above and Darth Vader's shot from below. And I asked them, how does it make you feel when you looked at them in that shot? You know, what does it tell you about the person? One of them said, when it pointed at Darth Vader, it made me feel like I was looking at my dad. And it's like, you know, he's not a Darth Sith Lord. It was the fact that, you know, I was looking up at him. So that's really interesting. That's what it's tapping into, is this sense of being beneath this person, being reliant on this person having all the power. You know, when you're a child, you're looking up at everything, including your parents, and that you're reliant on them. And they are, you know, they have power over you, you know, that they make your decisions for you. That's why it responds. That's why just a simple example like that works. A clip from Hidden Figures we were talking about of characters moving and being on same levels. So walking downstairs and being at the same level, coming to talk to someone at the same level rather than being above them or below them. And just small examples like that of how you can communicate and things you need to think of when you put shots together. And you're it's not enough just to go, I want it in close up because it looks good, you know, or whatever. I want it in closer because I want to rob my audience of the information surrounding that character. I want to see every micro movement of that character when they respond to this action, because this is the important part. Okay, good. You've got a good artistic basis in that then. And people will feel that. They'll get it. They'll feel that awkwardness and stuff. If you shot that situation, whatever it is, in a wide, then you let all the air out of it and you let it deflate, because I can look around and see something. And identifying these things will help make that connection, help make that feeling with your audience. And it's why, you know, same Flawless, when the father's rescued at that moment, we immediately cut to a slow-mo close-up of the daughter as she watches herself save her dad. And you see every micro movement of her as she's looking like that, because that is the key moment. And she walks by in slow-mo as well, and everything slows down, and we worship that image for a moment, because it's why we're here. You know, this is the reason why we're here. So let's show you it in slow-mo like that. And close up, because I want to see every detail of her reaction and her response. And that's understanding those things, and understanding how your audience responds to material is key when you want to make them feel something and get that. So I think you have to take into consideration how we just operate as human beings. And that'll get them where you want them.
What a lovely way to go. That'll get them where you want them. I like it. Okay.
That'll make them mind.
Yeah, we can start tying it up, but is there anything that you want people to like see of yours? Like, where do you want us to like look you up online, or what do you want to promote, or where should we go to watch Flawless? Lifelike. Flawless, where do we go to watch Lifelike? Where do we go to watch Dolls? Where do we see these things?
So Flawless and Dolls are both freely available on my Vimeo channel, which is vimeo.com/badshoesfilm. Bad Shoes is BADSHOES. So you can find those there. They're also on my YouTube channel, which is, if you just put Bad Shoes Film into YouTube, you'll find them on there as well. Lifelike is currently not available online due to restrictions with festival submissions. It's currently on the festival circuit, and it will be on the festival circuit for probably about another 10 months, I think, or so. We've got a good feeling about it, and hopefully it'll get selected for a few other things. Was Not Heard, which I mentioned, is freely available on my Vimeo channel. Things like Girl A and Jess's work, you can find all of that on her. If you go to Vimeo and put in Small Person Productions, you'll find her on there. And all of her films like Hidden and Girl A. Oh, Hidden actually will be on Lesflix soon. So if you go to Lesflix, you'll find it on there. But Girl A and Coping and all the other ones I mentioned of hers are all on there as well. Who else? Yeah.
Can I ask why Bad Shoes? Why the name?
Why Bad Shoes? It's from a really bad pair of shoes, which at the time was about just before I got into the community studios, talking about 20 years ago, and I worked at the Mercury and I wasn't public facing. So I'd walk into work in my trainers and then put on a pair of shoes and then walk home in my trainers. And the shoes that I had were just at the work were just falling apart. And they were like, you know, no, you're not public facing, but Jesus, you know, can you get some shoes that actually, you know, and we started a fantasy football league, and I just called my team like AFC Bad Shoes. And it went from there. And now it sort of flipped as into that whole bad is good type thing. So like my shoes are bad and I tried to buy a nice pair of shoes. I've got a nice pair of old Adidas on at the moment. So there you go. So try and have a nice pair of shoes with them and do that.
I'm so glad I asked.
Yeah, there's no like nothing cryptic, it's just a bad pair of shoes. So yeah.
It's just funny because like obviously you've had that name for so long. I just wondered where it had kind of come from.
I'm kind of encouraged, like whenever we make films with young people and they're branching out to direct themselves, to establish themselves as a company as well. So not, you know, you don't have to register or anything, but give yourself a name and do it. And you know, Jess has got Small Person. Yasmin has got Tight Lines Productions, which is, these are really nice because it's kind of personal. Like Jess, because she's very small, she's about, you know, 5'2" or 5'3" around there, but she's quite small, and celebrates that. And Yaz is Tight Lines because her grandfather who passed away was a fisherman, and he'd say that all the time. He'd say tight lines and means good luck and that sort of thing. And Joel is Checkered Productions. I think it's because he wore a lot of checkered shirts. Which now he's branching out and he's in business himself, you know, he's DOP and he's doing really well. And so they've all got their own names and they all seem to mean something to them. Isaac, who I'm working at the moment, Isaac Hurst, his is Bright Eyes, which is just a little play on his name and stuff, which is nice, Bright Eyes Productions. So it gives them an identity and something personal to them as well. It means something to them. I think it's nice to have that.
And are there any other bits of advice that you would give to other people who are trying to make films or who are thinking about it?
Yeah, I think if you're looking to get into film, sort of regional cinemas, independent cinemas as well, things like the Phoenix in Leicester or Broadway in Nottingham or Quad in Derby, places that aren't usually a typical multiplex sort of thing, but an independent cinema or art cinema or something that you've got in your town or your region, you'll always find filmmakers there. You'll find people interested in film. There might even be groups for filmmakers ran out of that cinema as well. So you can get some really good contacts there and go and get making there. Finding other people is absolutely key and imperative to moving forward. It's once you've found those people, just keep making and keep improving and keep finding ways of finding out new information about, oh, how do I submit to festivals? What are the things I have to look out for? You know, if I want to produce a film like this, what do I need to take into consideration for that? And just immersing yourself in it is the way forward. If you do find that community of people, remember that collaborative working is the lifeblood of independent film. So if they've not got a budget, if they've not got money, that person, you know, be upfront and let people know that and let people make their own decision then of, yes, I'm still willing to work with you voluntarily and I'm not going to get paid. Okay, fine. You know, I've done so many more projects free of charge than I have paid because I know I'm going to learn from them, but it needs to be my decision. So making sure people are aware whether it's a passion project or not is a good way forward. Maintaining good working relationships with people respecting their talent and their time that they're going to give you as well, free of charge, and respecting that and appreciating it is important. But your first steps really get to a cinema, get to an independent cinema, find a film group, find people who are making films, and find out if you can join them and if you can work with them. And then, like I say, value and appreciate what they do and treat it with respect.
Brilliant. I don't think we're going to get a better ending than that. So I'm just going to say, like, it's been really nice meeting you. You are like the only person I've had on this podcast that I've never met before. And it's been like really good to kind of, you know, hear some of the things that I've kind of thought myself and heard other people say, but also get like a new perspective. Because I think you're the only person I've spoken to who is just filmmaking, whereas everyone else is kind of like filmmaking around, you know, balancing money from some other source or.
Yeah.
No, it's been really good. Really,
I know it's been really nice to talk. Really nice to meet you as well. I'm going to switch my video on. Just risk it, just to say. See you later.